Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Friday, March 8th, 2024 edition of On Iowa Politics. On this week's episode, we'll talk about the Iowa Democratic Caucus results. The winner of the Iowa Republican caucuses having a good week, and more AEA drama in the Iowa legislature. Hello, everyone. I'm Aaron Murphy, the Des Moines Bureau Chief for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. With me this week are Gazette Deputy Bureau Chief Tom Barton. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Aaron.
Lead Des Moines Bureau Chief Caleb McCullough is here. Hello, Caleb.
The state of the podcast is strong, Aaron.
Indeed it is. And we also have with us Jared McNett of the Sioux City Journal. Hello, Jared.
The spice must flow, Aaron.
Oh, is it out? Have you seen it? Did you go like Thursday night?
No, my grand imperium has been disrupted in the past few days, so I will be seeing it over the weekend.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I don't have like immediate plans, but I definitely will be seeing. Okay, we start this week with the Iowa caucuses. Oh, we missed them so much. This week, Iowa Democrats announced the results of their newfangled all-male participation presidential precinct caucuses. So a comically succinct review here for any who are unfamiliar or need a reminder. The Iowa Democratic caucuses used to be first in the nation, and over the course of this past cycle, the National Party decided that would no longer be the case. Before that plug was officially pulled, Iowa Democrats, in a last-ditch effort to keep their first-in-the-nation status, completely overhauled their complex caucus system, changing it to a de facto straw poll by mail. It didn't work. The party still booted them out of the early voting window. But the Iowa Democrats decided to keep the new format anyway. They held their caucuses on January 15th, same as Iowa Republicans and before any other states. But they didn't cast their presidential preference that night. And that was the key difference. The results of those votes by mail were announced this past week on Super Tuesday. All right, now that you're all caught up, let's talk about those results. Obviously, not surprisingly, incumbent Democratic President Joe Biden won handily, receiving 91% of the votes. Uncommitted had a good caucus finish, placing second with 4%, so congratulations to Uncommitted. Dean Phillips's quixotic primary challenge hit 3% in Iowa, and candidacy waffling Marianne Williamson managed to get 2% of the caucus results. Since nobody else reached 15%, which was a requirement, Joe Biden will get all of Iowa's delegates. So none of that's terribly surprising. This was bound to be in a slow caucus year anyways. But here may be the even bigger number as we look at this and look forward. As of Tuesday afternoon, just more than 12,000 presidential preference cards, straw poll ballots, whatever you want to call them, were returned by Iowa Democrats. That is not a big number. Now, in fairness, like I said, this was always going to be a low interest affair because the party has the incumbent president. The 12,000 is low. Caleb, you covered the results announcement. What did Iowa Democrats have to say about this new process and that quote unquote turnout?
Yeah, well, you won't be surprised to hear that they thought it went over well. Iowa Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart has been saying for a long time that this was the most accessible caucus the party has ever held. And she, you know, reiterated that on Tuesday. Conducting it by mail allowed people who work nights or have young children who aren't able to bring them out for multiple hours or any other reason that you can't come to the caucus site, still allowed them to cast their vote and make their voice heard. But as you mentioned, it was still quite a low return rate. It was lower than 2012 when incumbent President Obama was running, and it was, you know, another non-competitive caucus cycle.
Thank you. Sorry to jump in. I was looking for that this week and couldn't find it. Do you remember what that number was from 2012?
It was something like 15,000. It was around there.
Thank you.
And so they didn't quite get there. What that's attributed to, this is obviously a new process. Not every Democrat in the state probably knew all the details about this. I imagine there's less Democrats in the state now than there were in 2012. It was not the biggest turnout for them. Also, much, much lower turnout than the Republican 2020 non-competitive caucuses, which I'm not going to guess because I don't know off the top of my head, but I do know that it was higher. But they still, you know, they still said that it was a success, and they Rita Hart, you know, talked about at the party headquarters on Tuesday, wanting to, you know, going forward, strategize about how to tweak the mail-in process and also how to get people to come out to the in-person caucus, even when they don't have a presidential preference vote on that day. Obviously, the caucuses for a long time have been a really useful party organizing tool for the parties, especially in competitive primaries. Those candidates appear here a lot and they drive voter registration, they drive interest. Without that, Iowa Democrats who are already losing their success in statewide elections every year are going to have more trouble building that organization. So that's something that Rita Hart said that she wants to work on. I will mention the Iowa Republican Party was not happy about it, as they have been for the last several months. The Chairman Jeff Kaufman held a press conference today where he said that the decision to do the mail-in caucus, even after New Hampshire and Iowa kind of came to an agreement on New Hampshire not jumping ahead of Iowa in the process, he thinks it still threatens Iowa's first in the nation status in the long run. His kind of contention was that Iowa Democrats should have simply held their party organizing or their presidential preference caucuses in January, violated the party rules and lost those delegates to the national convention. He says if that had happened on the Republican side, that's what he would have done. So, you know, two different approaches to how these things should be done. But it was interesting to watch this play out for the first time.
Yeah. Sorry, real quick, Caleb, I wanted to follow up on something you mentioned, because I often say I wish this was a video podcast in some ways, because I wish everybody could see the reactions that I'm going to see when I say this, especially to you, Caleb and Tom. I had a very brief Twitter exchange on Super Tuesday night about the whole turnout thing, and someone said there was more media coverage about them on caucuses, the Democratic caucus, on Tuesday than there was in the preceding 3 months. So most people found out about it when it was too late to participate. If I said anything over these past months and years, it's that you guys aren't writing enough about the Iowa Democratic caucuses, Tom and Caleb. We just didn't cover that at all, and shame on you.
I think every Iowa publication had an explainer about how the Iowa Democratic Party was operating this year.
Does that sound familiar to you, Tom? An explainer?
Vaguely. Yeah. I think I vaguely recall writing maybe a story, multiple stories. Yeah, multiple stories about that. I get it. I understand the criticism, you know, whether it's warranted or not. And I did hear from some Democrats who said that, you know, they were getting messages from other Democrats confused and thinking that they could participate on Super Tuesday and having to explain to them, nope, sorry, missed the deadline. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that is an absolutely fair point, that there was, I mean, separately, and this is going to sound obvious coming from me, but that's not a failure of the media. We definitely were talking about this for a long time in the process, but I do understand that is separate from that. Yes, I am not surprised at all that there was confusion and people who had not been paying attention and didn't realize until it was too late. Sorry, go ahead, Caleb.
And it's just one of those circumstances where when people say there's no media coverage of this, it just means it's not showing up in my social media feeds and I'm not seeking it out. And so
I did some light Googling for 2 seconds and I didn't see a link in the first couple of search results.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were two things that kind of stood out to me. And one of them is that it seems like announcing the results on Super Tuesday is a real uphill battle in terms of coverage, because with so many other states with way more delegates going on the same day, if you're hoping to get covered like outside of Iowa, you're competing with a lot. So I don't know that an announcement timed like that does a state party any favors at all. The other thing was the 4% uncommitted vote. I would be curious to know when those were coming in, because I know they could request preference cards up through the 19th of February. And by that point, the Michigan primary hadn't happened yet, but there was already the uncommitted vote to protest Biden's handling of the Israel-Hamas war. So I would be curious how much of that 4% in Iowa was specifically protesting that, or it was just, you know, people just wanting to vote for someone other than Biden for any other number of reasons. And I think, you know, as other people have said, that'll be a thing to keep looking for the rest of the primary cycle, what that uncommitted number is in any given number of states. In Michigan, it was like 13%. In Minnesota this week, it was like 18%. So that's definitely worth paying attention to.
Yeah, because if nothing else, it speaks to the Democratic enthusiasm, right? Which matters when you're looking ahead to the general election and his ability to turn out the base, you know, that section of his electorate when he's going up against Donald Trump. All right, moving on. And speaking of Iowa caucus winners, former and trying to again be President Donald Trump had a super, super Tuesday, winning all but one state as he essentially drove the final nail into his challenger's collective coffin. The last competitor standing was Nikki Haley, and she bowed out of the primary the next day. So, Jared, I guess Iowa gets to thumb its nose at the rest of the country and tell them I told you so. I was going to ask you here what you think about Trump's dominating run that started in Iowa and has continued through Super Tuesday, but maybe just for old time's sake, I should ask you in that grand On Iowa Politics podcast tradition one last time, Jared, is there still time for someone else to catch Donald Trump?
I think Perry Johnson has Trump right where he wants him. One-on-one, Donald versus Perry. It's Perry's time to shine. I will say, in the end, the Iowa caucuses weren't quite dead on with anticipating the final results. They did choose the eventual nominee, which is not what happened in 08, 12, or 16. But the margins here weren't quite what the margins became later. And that's true for both Trump and Haley. Obviously, for Trump, that's true because he was splitting his vote with, you know, DeSantis and Ramaswamy. But Haley, you know, did much better in terms of averages across all the other races combined. Her percentage, I think, was around like 32% if you take all the states together. And in Iowa, she was way less than that. She was at like 19%.
19, but yep.
Yeah, so, you know, in terms of those percentages, especially with Haley, Iowa wasn't quite predictive, but it was more predictive than some of the past cycles.
Yeah. And what that also does is we now have, you know, the confirmation that it's all but official now that we get the rematch that absolutely everybody wanted. And by everybody, I mean nobody. Do we have any thoughts? I got to tell you, I heard, oh, it was Maggie Haberman. I caught CNN and she was asked this question, like, what should we expect over the next eight months. And Maggie Haberman just basically said, it's going to be rough. I guess the good news is here in Iowa, we're not a toss-up state. So nobody cares about us here, right? What are you all doing to gear up for the next 8 months?
I mean, I think we got a preview last night in the State of the Union about what kind of Biden's election is going to be, his election strategy is going to be. You saw him, and I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the reaction was that it was a side of Biden that I think hadn't been super public so far. He was a little more feisty and he was a little more willing to, or just kind of combative in general. And, you know, he is talking about independence of Ukraine. He's talking about the January 6th. He's talking about, you know, I am a candidate who's for democracy here and abroad. My predecessor, he's talking about Donald Trump, is, you know, he's telling Putin to do whatever the hell you want. He's, you know, was involved in the January 6th insurrection. And then also you saw him kind of moderating on the border and in a way that I think made a lot of progressives upset last night, especially when he used the term illegal to refer to a undocumented immigrant. Yeah, I think he displayed kind of a lot of what his campaign is going to be about. And I think it looks like they're going to be going, you know, a lot more on the offensive about Trump now that it's clear that he's the nominee.
The my predecessor thing in particular is definitely a way of needling Trump, because I feel like he would have appreciated it a lot more if Biden was just saying his name over and over again, as opposed to getting all those digs in, but never actually saying Donald Trump.
And then he also had, I was reading about and listening to the audio, he had a hot mic moment where he was saying that he and BB are going to have a come to Jesus moment. So what's it good? Dark Joe or what's
Dark, Dark Brandon.
Dark Brandon. Thank you. Yeah. It sounds like Dark Brandon was unleashed last night. So it'll be interesting. So we were talking about this a little bit before we switched the record button on. I don't know how many people caught the State of the Union Republican response from J.D. Britt, but maybe the best way to sum it up was one of the reactions I saw this morning, which was a GIF or meme of a huge crowd of people fighting each other. And it was captioned with the women from Saturday Night Live arguing with each other over who gets to play Katy Britt in the cold open on Saturday night. So if that tells you how that went, let me add also, someone also noticed that the National Republican social media accounts are also posting photos and captions of her speech. Nobody in those Republican groups are posting video clips. So if you haven't seen it, find your way to it.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, we were talking about it before, and as I've kind of said repeatedly, like, it really is a very, very thankless job to get. One of the ones I immediately thought of was because she was in a kitchen in 2017, I think, Steve Beshear, the former governor of Kentucky, gave the Democratic response to Trump. And if I remember correctly, he was in like a mess hall or something like that. So
I don't remember that.
There are like people milling around behind him, which made it just like very confusing. And it was like way too much, like trying to be folksy kind of thing.
which always the case almost regardless of party. Oh goodness. Yeah. That was the other thing we talked about. Like, yeah, the one thing we'll say in fairness to Katy Britt is that's one of those things that really you only get remembered for if it goes wrong. Nobody still talks about a State of the Union response because of how great it was. So as we said, maybe that's congratulations to our own Iowa governor, Kim Reynolds, because she managed to deliver one of those without going viral somehow. So that's as big as a win as you can get.
Honestly, the move should be like whatever party you are giving the response, the move should just be like they cut to you and you just say like, yeah, everything you just heard was a lie, and then just end your response there.
Back to you, Tom. All right. Lastly, this week, we got to head back to that Iowa Capitol and that one topic that we just cannot escape, area education agencies. I actually wasn't even necessarily planning on us talking about AEAs again this week. But then on Tuesday, the Iowa Senate scheduled its AEA bill for debate and then pulled it. And then after that, they didn't do any floor debate at all for the rest of the week. So that's not a common occurrence. Better than 90% of the time when the Senate puts a bill on its debate calendar, the chamber debates that bill. So that was interesting. It was noteworthy. It kind of had us all talking at the Capitol about what's going on. And I don't know that we have a clear picture of that yet. It'll be interesting in the this coming week as we have another funnel coming up. Tom, what does that move suggest to you? And the House barely passed its bill, even with the 13 Republicans to spare. Does this move by the Senate suggest that Senate Republicans don't have the votes to pass the bill? What do you think's happening here?
Yeah, I think it does signal that Senate Republicans don't have the votes to pass their proposal. What's unclear is whether they would have votes to pass the House proposal. I did hear that there were, well, at least one Senate Republican who said, you know, they had serious concerns, doubts, reservations, whatever you want to say, about the Senate proposal, and then said, why don't we just pass the House proposal? That seems to be a lot more palatable to, you know, the various stakeholders involved in this issue, you know, the AEA's superintendents, education professionals in Iowa, members of the caucus. But there are also Senate Republicans, however, who are, you know, adamant about their proposal, which aligns more closely with the governor's proposal and what she's put forward, and strongly believe that there needs to be more flexibility provided to school districts in how the funding that goes to the ADAs is utilized, and giving them, again, more options, more flexibility, the ability to actually control those dollars instead of it being passed through to the AEAs. But you have a lot of concerns among Republican lawmakers who are in rural districts or have rural school districts that are worried about the impacts of that and the ability of these rural districts to be able to either on their own or collectively together provide, you know, a comprehensive special education program. And we saw that during the House debate of the House bill, that was giving them a lot of concern and heartburn, and why you probably didn't see as much, as you mentioned, Aaron, as much support among even House Republicans for their proposal.
Yeah, I mean, this thing is going to be so fascinating. And I apologize, because I want to acknowledge here that this is a very real issue. This has very real world impacts on AEAs, schools, special ed students. This is all super important stuff. So please forgive me for kind of neglecting to talk about that and focusing on the politics and procedural part of this, but it really is fascinating, and it's going to be interesting to see moving forward now too what happens with this because of all the things we just described. And I mean, that the Senate and / governor are so far from where the House is on this, and I don't know how they get to something that all three parties can sign. I mean, like I said, The House bill passed with 53 votes, and at least two Republicans stood up and said how uneasy they were about those yes votes. So if that version barely gets past the House, how does the Senate version get passed? But then conversely, there's clearly a segment of the Senate Republican caucus that wants nothing to do with the House bill. So they can't just pass that. And I think it's fair to wonder whether the governor wants that House bill either. It just does such a small percentage of what her original proposal does. So I don't know. I just, like I said, logistically, politically, find this fascinating to see what's going to happen with this. And I hope I don't regret saying that and be back here at the end of April, because that's the one bill that's still keeping us from adjourning for the session. It's not impossible to imagine that being the case, but I don't know. It's going to be interesting.
I was going to say, wasn't there some other floor-related weirdness this week?
So one thing we wanted to bring up really quick, again, and this is more about procedure, but it was really rare and fascinating. We had two examples of bills being brought up on floor debate in the House that didn't get passed for different reasons, but that is exceptionally rare for any of us, any listeners out there who don't follow that stuff super closely. By the time a bill gets called up for debate on the floor, the leadership is 99.99% positive that that's going to pass, if not 100% positive. They don't call it up for a vote until they know they've got enough votes to pass it. So it's just absolutely exceptionally rare. I can count on my one hand the number of times I can remember it happening in 12 years covering the legislature. Now, the funny thing is, I can think of three, and two of them happened this week, just to tell you how rare that is. The first one passed because they literally found out they didn't have enough votes. And this was the, help me out, Tom and Caleb. I want to make sure I don't get the two wrong.
The groundwater regulation.
Yeah, the ground and stormwater regulations bill. That's what I thought. And for a second, my brain was telling me, no, that's the other one. And that was all extra interesting because they went through debate. There were certain concerns raised. It was very normal. Seemed like it was headed for a passage, maybe a little closer than usual, but it was going to pass. And the vote, we're sitting there as the voting machines open and the votes are starting to pop up on the board. And it freezes on 49 for a good 30 seconds to a minute. And then apparently it became obvious that 50 and 51 weren't there. And it actually lost votes. People started changing their yes votes to no's, and I think it wound up with 44. Does that sound right? 44, 45, somewhere around there. So that was super unusual. And then the second one was the bill that was designed to require fathers to kind of add to their financial support requirements, similar to child support, but make a few things also require them to provide financial support during pregnancy. That was the intention of the bill, but Democrats raised some concerns about how it could be used by someone with ill intent, because part of the bill would require the mother to take a paternity test. And when there's no physical baby yet, while you're still pregnant, the only way to do that is through some really invasive and in some cases risky procedures. And that discussion went on for a while. And then all of a sudden, Majority Leader Matt Winchell, a Republican, gets up and says, we're deferring on the bill. We're not talking about this one anymore. They didn't even make it to the vote on that one. So that was fascinating too. So we had a couple of them this week. Caleb or Tom, was there anything that struck you guys about those either debates or those moments? I mean, it shocked me sitting there as a veteran. I will say that we already see the topsoil ones back on the debate calendar for next week. So maybe they think they can get to 51. There were some people missing, but I don't know. That surprised me. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just, you know, the reason these things never happen is because when a party's in the majority, they are very meticulous about planning and counting how many votes they have for things. And they, you know, they're not going to be pulling up bills that they don't have the votes for. So I guess it's just, you know, something in the House caucus is not quite working like it's supposed to, where they're not getting a consensus on these bills before they pull them up to the floor, or they thought that, you know, maybe they think they have a consensus. A couple people that didn't expect to be gone are gone. Yeah, it is very interesting. And on the pregnancy one, it seemed that the bill's floor manager, John Wills, was just not really prepared for the questioning that the Democrats were bringing. It just seemed like something that hadn't been considered before in subcommittee and committee until it got to the floor. So it was the steps that should be happening seem to have not happened on some of these bills.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I'll raise here that I don't know the answer to this because I didn't cover that bill in its early steps. You mentioned sub and regular committee. The one thing I would say in fairness to John Wills is, were those questions raised? And if they weren't, like, you know, I mean, you can argue that due diligence should have been done by the bill's managers, sponsors anyways, but it is kind of fair to ask, like, were these concerns raised before we got to the floor? I mean, why? And I, you know, I suppose, I can't remember if Brian Meyer, the Democrat from Des Moines, who's also an attorney, you know, if it's not a bill in your committee, a lot of these legislators don't see these bills until they get to floor debate, you know, until they get to the caucus, you know, the people on the subcommittee, the people on that committee really manage those bills. You've got your own that you're watching. So maybe it was a case of something like that it took an attorney looking at this and analyzing it that way. Same for Megan Srinivas, the Democratic rep who's a physician. Those were the two who were really pointing out the possible fatal flaws in that one. And maybe they were just seeing it for the first time that day too. I suppose that's possible.
No, Representative Srinivas, I believe, was on the subcommittee and the committee.
There you go.
And brought up the issue of testing and how you would establish paternity during pregnancy, and said that it potentially would require an invasive procedure for the mother. And my recollection from being at the subcommittee and the committee was that she didn't really press the issue. You know, she just kind of brought it up as a potential concern, and the response from Representative Wills is, well, there are options, there are ways to establish paternity during pregnancy, but didn't get into specifics, and there wasn't really a whole kind of debate or back and forth on that. Again, it was brought up as a concern during the committee and subcommittee, but my recollection was there wasn't really substantial debate or discussion on that point, and I don't know that Democrats really pushed as heavily against it as they did during the floor debate.
Yeah. Okay. That's good to know. That's interesting. And look, you know, hey, at the end of the day, the floor debate is part of the process too. So it's, you know, now those questions have been raised, and even if it had passed the House, it's still got to go through the Senate. So it's not like it's some kind of Cardinals send that it took this long. You'd like to think that things like that would get caught sooner, but it didn't. But it got caught before it was sent and signed. So I guess ultimately that it's still part of the process. That, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of life that bill has moving forward. Sorry, Caleb, go ahead.
I had the thought last week, actually, during a 3-hour debate on the social studies standards bill about, you know, was there ever a time when, you know, floor debate in politics was, or in government was a time for people to actually weigh their position on an issue and you know, oh, maybe the Republicans are going to be thinking about what the Democrats say and the Democrats are going to be thinking about the Republicans say, oh, and maybe if people are going to change their votes. Like, did that ever happen? And hey, look, it seems like it's happening now. So interesting.
Yeah. It was super interesting. And like I said, super rare. And you're right. It is, you go into debate thinking, obviously the books are cooked on this. And here was an example where maybe that debate actually mattered and minds were actually changed on the floor. Fascinating to watch. All right. That's it for this episode of On Iowa Politics. We appreciate you tuning in. If you're not already, please subscribe to us on your streaming service of choice. You can also find the podcast each week on your preferred Gazette or Lee newspaper website. And now that you've listened to the On Iowa Politics podcast, make sure you're also subscribed to the On Iowa Politics newsletter, where every morning in your inbox, you'll receive all the latest politics and government coverage from our team. You can subscribe to that free newsletter at the Gazette's website, thegazette.com. And a quick programming note and reminder here, the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio host Pints and Politics with our very own Tom Barton and Todd Dorman, who join other folks to talk national, state, and local politics. It's sort of like an interactive in-person version of this podcast. So last month, they held a packed event at Big Grove in Cedar Rapids. You can listen to that audio from that event the same way you listen to this podcast. We'll have that Pints and Politics episode linked in this episode's description. And then for your scheduling purposes, the next Pints and Politics event will be Thursday, April 25th at Big Grove in Cedar Rapids. So if you're in the area, I've done one of those in the past too. They're really funny. Real fun event. Definitely check it out. And lastly, don't forget that the work of everyone you heard here today can be found on the pages and websites of the Quad City Times, Muscatine Journal, Cedar Rapids Gazette, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, Mason City Globe Gazette, Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil, and the Sioux City Journal. Spotlight by Chai Songwriter featuring Alicia Monet is playing us out this week. If you know an Iowa band or musician who should be featured on the podcast, please send us a sound file. For Tom Barton, Caleb McCullough, Jared McNett, and our producer, Bailey Chihan, I'm Aaron Murphy. Thanks for listening.
Can't get enough of the Gazette? Listen to the Gazette Daily News podcast for the latest Eastern Iowa headlines packed into bite-sized stories. Listen at thegazette.com or Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or through your Amazon Alexa device. Tell it to enable the Gazette Daily News skill, then say, Alexa, what's my flash briefing?